Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
My ultimate conclusion is that we can't outrun the virus, and that this is what we're going to be living with for the foreseeable future. We're never going to say that there's nothing that would cause us to change our plans. You know, one thing we're learning with this virus is so much is unpredictable. So, you know, we're not saying full steam ahead no matter what happens. We're going to see how this continues to play out, but we feel very comfortable right now with where we are.
Okay, well, if Adam Silver is very comfortable, then that tells you something, because I know he's not going to just jump into this thing without due diligence and without the best information. So he's confident enough that the NBA is going to restart, and they will do so, thankfully, without the Chicago Bulls. Here to talk about everything that is going on in basketball is Mark Schanowski, and he's on Twitter at Mark Schanowski, Bulls and NBA analyst for NBC Sports Chicago. He is on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. How you hanging in, Mark?
It's been a rough period, Dan. I'll tell you what, when you get to be my age, you kind of run your life around live games and not having games to watch. It's been tough, I'm not going to lie.
Well, they're coming back, though, and it does appear there's going to be some basketball. We've had some transactions. We saw none other than Joakim Noah actually finalizing what had been long rumored, that he is going to help fortify the Clippers front court. What are you watching closely here as we start to get some, you know, the positive tests that are rolling in and just sort of figuring out now who's going to get where and when and how it's all going to restart? I keep thinking until it happens, you know, it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, we're still a month away, and when you see the spike in cases in Florida, in the Orlando area, you just worry about how can you possibly bring that many people into one location and be able to stay together for 3 months without a virus epidemic really shutting the thing down. And I know Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts of the Players Association have talked about it at length. They put in the best health and safety protocols they can possibly come up with, but there's so many variables, so many things we don't know about the virus, that if we have a situation where one team is particularly hit hard by the virus, it's going to just destroy the legitimacy of the playoffs. If you get a team, you know, LeBron and AD are out, the Lakers would be eliminated right away, and you'll have to look at your champion. Is that going to be a legitimate champion over a long season when some of the best players were knocked out by the virus?
Well, what are NBA players saying about it? Because they really matter more than we do. That is one league where they kind of self-police when it comes to legitimacy, when they'll be on Twitter and jousting with each other, current players, former players, how many rings do you have? It's sort of I guess that fashion was sort of set by Jordan and Barkley and some of these guys, where that's why you see guys go ring hunting. You see guys end up in their career so they can say they've got one, because they talk about it in and amongst themselves.
I'm sure the reactions to different players are all over the gamut. I mean, some people are going to be concerned about their safety. Some people are going to be concerned about possibly infecting their family members who are going to be able to join them after the first round of the playoffs in Orlando. There's just so many different ways you can look at this situation. And I think for some of the young players, the youngest are probably thinking, you know, we're 22, 23 years old. We're invincible. You know, even if we get the virus, it's not going to be anything that's going to be serious or cause any long-term damage to our bodies. And they're feeling like it's certainly not a risk that they're afraid to take. I think another thing that's going on with the player group is they're just wondering, what am I going to do in Orlando for 3 months? You know, just, you know, playing cards and playing ping pong and whatever. You know, if you leave the compound, you have to be isolated for 10 days. So guys aren't just going to run off because the penalties are pretty severe for that. Guys are going to get bored. You know, they're used to having their lifestyles and being able to come and go the way they would like to. And I think that's going to be a hardship for these guys that they don't really realize what 3 months confined to a luxury hotel is going to be like. Obviously, they're going to have the best of everything there in terms of chefs and the way they're taken care of, but they're still going to be bored without really losing their personal freedoms to go out and do some of the things they like to do with their free time.
Are you hearing anything about the non-invite bubble teams being able to convene somewhere on their own for some kind of constructive work? Because that had been rumored. I know that had been requested, perhaps, with some of the teams saying, hey, we can't be without some sort of competitive basketball as this is all going on, even if it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I'm very pessimistic anything large scale is going to happen. Michelle Roberts was quoted last week in saying that they're not going to try to organize any kind of structure for these eight teams unless they can come up with the same level of health and safety that they have for the Orlando bubble. And that seems problematic, whether or not they tried a different location to bring these teams together. I think when they look at the fact that they already eliminated these teams from possible contention for the playoffs, why would they go to that great expense and planning just to organize scrimmage games between these eight bottom enders? There may be a situation where they're allowed to have mandatory mini camps in their own facilities, and maybe there's a situation where they can pair up with the partner that's closest to them geographically, like perhaps the Bulls could play Detroit or Cleveland and with a couple of scrimmages. But I don't think there's going to be anything where there's going to be a large-scale eight-team mini league in the summer or early fall. I just think it's too problematic when you consider all the time and expense they went into to try to guarantee the safety of the folks in Orlando. And obviously they're going to take a look at how things start in Orlando. Maybe if things are going smoothly, they'll revisit it, something they could do in September for the eight teams that weren't invited to Orlando.
So what is happening and what is not happening with the Bulls at the moment? Because I want to think that this is that time where Arturas Karnišovas is going about his business deliberately. But we don't know. We're trusting that he is in charge and making all these decisions and evaluating and doing the right things. But I don't know how he can really be evaluating with so little going on.
Well, the word on Karnišovas is that he's very patient, very detailed in the way he tries to make his decisions. And I would like to think that he's looking at the possibility of which coaching candidates might emerge as we go through this process. He might have his eye on somebody that is likely to be eliminated in the first round of the playoffs that he can talk to at that point. Let's face it, the Bulls aren't going to play a meaningful game until at least December. So there's no rush to get this decision other than the fact that you would like a new coaching staff to get their eyes on the players, to be able to go through these individual workouts, to be able to break down tape with guys. I think there is some value in making the change as quickly as possible. But if he and Mark Eversley have their eye on a particular individual or group of individuals that they'd like to interview for the position, they might just be biding their time until these guys become available. The fact that the season is going to be pushed back until the end of October is going to mean that a lot of these guys' contracts are going to be extended, and they may have to wait to talk to assistant coaches that they might be interested in. But other than that, it makes very little sense to wait, because this is a full-scale new approach to every aspect of the organization. So if you're going to make the coaching change, pull the Band-Aid off and get it done. I'm of the camp that they should get it done as soon as possible, unless there's some guy they're waiting to talk to that they view as their number one candidate.
See, I'm with you on that. I've said this just sort of glibly, that every day they go by with Jim Boylan still as their head coach, it makes them look dumber. And I don't know if it means they actually are dumber, but this has been the most obvious move that they absolutely have to make to have any credibility whatsoever, internally or externally, and they just haven't done it yet. And I don't know why they feel that he's got to stick around. I don't know if there's some contract language or some clause in a contract that gives them reason to extend it, and I don't have access to some of that information. But you had to have done the interviews. You had all this time to do nothing but do all of those those interviews. And I don't know what can be in place per NBA rule if it's Adrian Griffin, and if Adrian Griffin still has to go and do what he does and continue to play a role with his team. There's still a way to handle this right now where the proper message is sent that, yeah, we know what's going on. We're not just completely stagnant right now.
And they have been looking at different contract clauses. They picked up the option of one of their assistants, Nate Lenser, who is moved up to the front of the bench this season under Jim Boylan. He's going to be back. They've basically rounded out the front office with the people that they want to get in those different positions. So they have made some changes around the edges. And as you mentioned, one of the things that Arturis did talk about in his Zoom meetings with reporters is that he's had many meetings with the current roster over Zoom, and now that he's in Chicago, obviously he's done that face-to-face, and he's gotten all the feedback he could possibly need about what they feel about Jim Boylan and the current coaching staff. I can't imagine that he needed many face-to-face meetings with Jim to make his own evaluation in that regard. I mean, he's been breaking over game tape of what they've done under Boylan for the last 3 months, so he has a very good understanding of what the deficiencies were. You know, he said flat out that this team underachieved. Well, when a front office executive guy says that, that usually means the finger's pointed squarely at the coach. I don't know if there is some contractual issue that is causing them to wait, or just the fact that Michael Reinsdorf and John Paxson asked him to be patient in his evaluation of Boylan. But I'm kind of puzzled as you are as to why the decision hasn't been made. I would think that it would be of their benefit to try to make a decision in the short term so a new coaching staff could get in there, get established, and get to work.
What will new eyes on Chris Dunn mean?
You know, I think that Chris Dunn, we pretty much know who he is as a player. You know, he's a guy that is not going to be a threat on the offensive end. The way the game is played right now, the three-point shot is so important, especially from that point guard position, and he flat out just can't make that shot. He finished second in the league in steals this season. He's a very good on-ball defender. But, you know, now because of the pandemic, it affected the salary cap in a way with the reduction of games that he's going to have a higher qualifying offer, which is going to be $7.1 million. If I'm in charge, I'm not committing $7.1 million to Chris Dunn. I think he's a limited player. He's a good defender, but I don't think he gives you the complete skill set you need in a rotation guard at this point. They're fairly deep at that position. I would just say, you know, go on the marketplace and see what you can get. I think that committing that kind of money is probably a little bit much, especially when they're looking at trying to build this team and have some flexibility in terms of salary cap space. And we don't know what the cap is going to look like for the next couple of years because of the pandemic. Revenues have dropped, and the cap number is likely to drop both this year and next.
How do you think that informs their draft decision?
You know, I think that the last thing this team needs is another new young player. I think that they would be best served to try to trade that pick. The only issue with that is this draft is not considered to be very good by most talent evaluators, and that means the value of that pick is not going to be that high. There is a chance, of course, they could move into the top four when the lottery hits, and maybe that would make that pick a little bit more valuable. I think that they have to make some hard decisions early. I don't think you can just sit and wait and go, well, we've got a year to play with this. We can evaluate everybody, and then next summer we'll make our decisions. If the opportunity strikes, maybe there's a team out there that has some real financial pressures, and they're looking to move a fairly sizable contract of a high-quality NBA player. Take that lottery pick. Take the player that you've decided in your evaluations really doesn't fit with what you want to do going forward and make that trade now. That you might be able to get a better deal now than you could a year from now when teams know I have a better idea of what their financial situation is. I know that they probably want to be patient and evaluate some of these young guys. But, for example, say you've decided that Wendell Carter Jr. at 6'9 is not the center that fits with the way you want to run your system. You've got Lauri Markkanen most likely established at the power forward spot, assuming that they do at some point extend him. Put Wendell Carter Jr. in with the pick and see what you can get back. I think that, you know, we've waited so long for these pipe dreams of free agency. You know, every 2 or 4 years it comes up that, oh, the Bulls got cap space and they're going to be going big game hunting. And we've seen what that's resulted in. The hope is that Karnišević and the new front office and potentially a new coaching staff will make them more attractive to free agents. But until somebody comes, you have to assume that that's not the best route to go. I'm of the mind that you've got to be aggressive I think as the second youngest team, we've seen what that does in terms of your ability to play consistently on the court. I'm all for trying to bring in veterans if they become available either this offseason or at the trading deadline next year.
Strong stuff. Really appreciate it as always, Mark. Thank you.
Dan, good to talk to you. It'll be fun to see some games finally.
Yeah, I know. I know. Can't wait. Thanks, Mark.
All right, hang in there, buddy.
You too. That is Mark Schanowski, Bulls and NBA analyst for NBC Sports Chicago. The Chicago White Sox summer camp roster is indeed out, and it comprises 44 players. Now, this is not listed by main group or satellite group like other teams have done, including the Cubs. And I don't know if there's going to be a secondary facility for them. This is just one list. And I want to run through this. The names that stand out to me, and this is just first blush looking at this, the invites, Andrew Vaughn is on the list, the aforementioned slugger who was part of Lucas Giolito's Sacramento workouts. He is on the list, as is Nick Madrigal. So they're both listed among the infielders. Also, they've got some, you know, non-roster invitee, Chesler Cuthbert, who has had some major league time. But I don't see any other real surprises. The outfielders, Luis Basabe, Nicky Delmonico, Adam Engel, Eloy Jimenez, and Nomar Mazara, Luis Robert. So that's your group there. Infielders, Abreu, Anderson, Cuthbert, Encarnacion, Larry Garcia, Madrigal, Mendick, Moncada, Andrew Romine, and Andrew Vaughn. Four catchers, Zach Collins, Yasmani Grandal, James McCann, and Yermin Mercedes. Boy, was he just hitting bombs in Glendale. It was just crazy. Here's your full list of pitchers. I'll just run through it real quick. Drew Anderson, Aaron Bummer, Dylan C., Steve Cishek, Alex Colome, Jimmy Cordero, Ross Detweiler, Dane Dunning, Jace Fry, Carson Fulmer, Tyron Guerrero, Lucas Giolito, Gio Gonzalez, Ian Hamilton, Kelvin Herrera, Cody Hoyer, Tyler Johnson, Dallas Keuchel, Michael Kopech, Jimmy Lambert, Reynaldo Lopez, Evan Marshall, Carlos Rodon, and Jose Ruiz. Those are the names, and really, I guess Andrew Vaughn might be the one that raises an eyebrow here or there. We're going to continue our baseball discussion, find out what Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs thinks of these rosters, how they're constructed, what teams are doing, how they're handling it, and what we can tell from some of it, and also the not just the new roster regulations, but the new rules, what we know, what we understand, and what they can figure out over at Fangraphs. He's coming up next on The Score.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Terrence Gore is going to go in to run for Anthony Rizzo at first base. Gore has his lead, hands on knees. Now takes the hands off the knees. He's running. The pitch to Baez, a strike, stolen base. No throw from Butera. It was a breaking ball for a called strike to Baez. And now the tying run in scoring position, they basically just let him go.
Well, they had no chance. Ottavino's very slow to the plate. And Gore, if Ottavino's that slow to home again, he could easily steal third.
Adam Ottavino's 0-2 pitch. Here it comes. Swinging a line drive, base hit, left center field. Gore is going to score the tying run. Baez going for a double. The throw, he's got a double. Ball game tied. He lashed a double into left center. Terrence Gore scored the tying run. Gore was like a flash of lightning going around third base.
And now there's a spot for guys like that on these expanded rosters, and maybe you'll need that starting these extra innings with a guy on second base. That was Terrence Gore stealing a base and scoring from second in the 2018 NL wildcard game. You heard that here on Sports Radio 670, The Score, your home for Chicago Cubs baseball. Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs is on Twitter at Dan Zimborski. He's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. What's going on, Dan? How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm good, and I'm trying to learn some things from all of these rosters that are coming out. The White Sox just announced their roster. We saw the Cubs roster yesterday. Some teams have the full 60. Some are holding some spots open. Some are having dual training camps with a primary and a secondary. Others maybe with different facilities and are not doing so. What are you looking at to determine, I guess, the go-for-it level of some of these deployments?
I think what it comes down to is how willing teams are to put some of their top prospects who they might not want to amass surface time for financial reasons. I like to see those guys appear on the roster. I look at like the Tampa Bay Rays pool, and you see guys that could really bust through and give like a surprise shot in the arm to the roster down the stretch. But of course it depends on each team's depth, which obviously varies quite a bit.
Well, I also wonder what the advantage is to not filling out the full 60 right now. Is there flexibility there? What does that allow, for example, the Cubs to do by only having 50 or the White Sox only having 44? What are they planning with the extra spots?
I think that remains to be seen because we don't really know exactly what the season's going to look like. We're still a month away. We have a raging pandemic. The problem is that if you remove a player from the 60-man pool – for reasons unrelated, you know, injury, suspension, and the like, then that essentially gives them, puts them on waivers, so to speak, with the new rules. So it does make sense this far out to be a little cautious about how you fill up that roster. And to another extent, the Cubs don't have the deepest farm system at the moment.
And now that we do have the 30-man roster that will shrink after a couple of weeks to 28 and I believe then to 26, and we played that Terrence Gore highlight, and we know that the Cubs, they like their little speedy specialist guys usually during roster expansion in September, and now they're taking a look at this Ian Miller on the fringe of their roster being a no-hit sort of speed guy. Now that you can pinch run somebody if you want in these reimagined extra innings, do you think more teams are going to look for that kind of like a Herb Washington specialist?
I think that is an interesting and probably a smart path to take because we've never had this ghost runner rule before, except in, you know, independent ball and the minor league experiments with it. It kind of makes the Giants of all teams look almost like fortune tellers because they signed Billy Hamilton in the offseason, and Hamilton has his limitations as a player, obviously, but he's just the type of guy who you'd want to have on second starting the extra innings. So it's going to be fascinating to see with the rule changes this year, and of course the DH in the NL, which teams are especially clever, like who manages their rotation the best? What's the right way to do it? Because this is an unprecedented season in MLB history. We've had short seasons, but never 60-game seasons. So it's tragic, but it's also fascinating. We'll learn some things, I guess.
Well, and I would think as you look to some kind of statistical modeling, there's got to be a way to do it where, and obviously at Fangraphs, you're smarter than I, but I'm wondering, are you dividing previous seasons into 60-game chunks? Is there a way of randomizing 60-game sort of grabs over a given period of time to look for some signals in the data? Do you look to short-season minor league ball or split-season minor league ball? I mean, how do you determine expectations or what you – how do you know what you can know, I guess, is the question.
That of course, is a difficult question. I've looked a lot at season chunks when developing in-season projections because players are streakier than you would expect from simply their line. Like a 300 hitter isn't really a 300 hitter all the time. Based on the volatility of their performance in smaller chunks of seasons, a 300 hitter is likely a true 320 hitter sometimes and a true, quote-unquote, 280 hitter sometimes. I think that for projecting which players will turn out to be you know, unexpectedly good or poor. I don't think that's necessarily a good way to do that. I think to a very large extent, our projections are the same. The results are just the accuracy is just going to be much worse.
And adding to all this is still the uncertainty over what baseball we're going to get and whether or not this is going to be the ball that flies through the air, that slips through the air aerodynamically, or the ball with a little bit more grab on it that was apparently introduced in the playoffs last year, where you had some wall scrapers that used to be 10 rows up, based on how teams, you know, at what cost to power. If power comes just because the ball flies through the air, you don't have to pay as much for it. You don't have to set your roster thusly. How much of a sample size and how many exit velos and distances are we going to need overall to know what ball we've got?
We'll know fairly quickly by home run rates, but we won't really know beforehand because baseball has not been transparent at all with their ball. I contrast that with Korea, with the KBO. A few years ago, they said, we have too much offense. We're going to deaden the ball. They announced it. They did it. And we had results. MLB still barely acknowledges that there was anything with the baseball, and only slightly, even though it's quite obvious that the baseball has changed in the last few years. People who have dissected the ball, like I think Dr. Meredith Wills, have found significant differences with the baseball. And there was a real reason to think the baseballs were different in the playoffs last year. So unless baseball is a little more open than they are, it's going to be really hard to tell going in what we have.
Now, as we speak, you have just posted something, and I don't know if this is awesome or if this is cruel or both, but the headline is Zips Time Warp, Kerry Wood and Mark Pryor, an analysis by our guest Dan Zimborski. And you're talking about putting this in the DeLorean and looking at what could have been or maybe should have been based on some different outcomes. First of all, why did you want to do this? And when you got the results, what did you end up thinking about it?
Well, I've been doing Zips Time Warps for a while, is what I've been calling them, is people are always fascinated by the what-ifs in history. And I've done these occasionally from time to time for Ted Williams in Korea. And since there hasn't been any actual baseball, I've been doing more of them lately. I've done Joe Mauer without a concussion, Eric Davis with better health, and so on and so forth. Ken Griffey Jr. With better health in his 30s. So one of the requests I've gotten quite a lot has been Wood and Pryor. So I thought this would be fun to look at them. I mean, maybe not so fun for a Cubs fan, because there is a bit of a cruelty even with the 2016 World Series victory, because there were really good reasons to think that they would be the core of a really good Cubs team from the 2000s, and it just fell apart. And that happens with pitchers, but you have to think that they were even more unlucky than you would be on average.
I'm looking at a Mark Pryor Zips career of 62 wins, a war of 62. We're talking borderline Hall of Fame, and in your words, the line of a poor man's Pedro Martinez. Damn.
Which just does not sound as much like an insult as it could come off as. Pedro Martinez was, of course, amazing. The thing about Pryor is he was so polished so quickly. I think people forget that he debuted less than a year after he was drafted. He didn't even play in the minors at the end of 2001. He essentially had 6 weeks in the minors, and he went right to the majors fully formed. I think without the injuries, there's actually a chance he would have gotten even better than he was, which is pretty difficult to do because he was, you know, third in the Cy Young race in 2003. I think that there were some holes in Kerry Wood's game, relatively speaking. He didn't have the control that Pryor did. But I think Pryor, I mean, with the injuries, we were very likely robbed one of the elite pitchers of the generation.
Last thing before we let you go, as you and Jay Jaffe and everybody there at Fangraphs, as you sit around and try to figure out overall what your editorial approach is going to be to this season, is it going to be to, in general, divine knowledge as quickly as possible, and everybody being mathematically inclined to wait for sample sizes? You know, how aggressive overall do you think the analysis can be of this season when, you know, as Joe Sheehan likes to say, he always says when the playoffs start, variance swamps everything. This is an entire season of variance. This is an entire season of unknowns. Yet we count on you. You know, we're all counting on you because we need the smart people to do the smart people things, even when you kind of can't.
Yeah, this year is going to be unlike any season we've seen. One thing I've said is that this is the season in baseball history in which talent is the least important to a team's success. And, I mean, that sounds like a weird thing to say, but in baseball, 60 games is almost nothing. Anything can happen in 60 games. And that's been reflected in some of the projections I've posted, because I even projected the Orioles to have better than a 1% chance of making the playoffs.
Oh my goodness.
And I still can't imagine what world the Orioles make the playoffs in. If you look at their player pool, you wonder if they made up half the names. I think a lot of what we know about baseball just won't be in play this season, because the difference between a good baseball team and a lousy baseball team is so much smaller than it is in the NFL or the NBA. So I think we'll see, you know, some teams that we thought were run of the mill. You have a first good, say you start the season hot and go 12-2. A quarter of the season's over at that point. It's going to be just an odd season. I don't know how to stress that enough.
I also think, too, that it would be fascinating, and I don't have the data on this, but the conventional wisdom of the stud rookie that has his day in the sun, and then the league finds the holes in his swing or finds some sequence of pitches that says, okay, now I gotcha, and now they kind of reel him in. It might be, if a team wants to promote somebody and say, hey, kid, just go do you, and while they're still throwing you fastballs, that maybe you get to the end of the season before some of those things are figured out.
Yeah, it is a possibility, and I think that even apart from that, it's in the interest of some teams to promote these guys, because you have to remember there's no minor league season this year. I know they haven't made that official announcement yet, but everybody knows that there's not going to be minor league baseball this year. And with top prospects, I mean, if you don't bring them up, there's a risk that you have these guys go a year without playing actual competitive baseball. So that's another opportunity for teams to do something that maybe other teams aren't doing as well. But it would be fascinating to see someone like Casey Mize come in, throw, you know, a ton of pitches for a month, and then just have the season be over before anybody figures anything out. So I am looking forward to the season in this respect as much of an outlier as this year is going to be.
Dan Zaborski, thanks as always. Appreciate the information.
Thanks for having me.
That is Fangraphs senior writer Dan Zaborski on Sports Radio 670. We have the Midday Midway coming up, and I'm going to make this a little bit sportsy. It's going to be fun, and it's going to be sportsy. I would say that we need to convene a certain well-known police force on these airwaves, but the reality is we don't. This was a self-solving case at the Travelers in Connecticut over the weekend. And I want to get into a little bit of what we saw and some history, some golfing history that was made, because I watched a lot of it, and there were some things once again to be watching out there. Also, this is an anniversary of something that happened in sports. It's something that we were watching live while on the air, and it's something after which something memorable occurred. It happened 13 years ago, and we've got the full play-by-play call, and we're going to remember a particular event. We'll talk some golf, we'll talk some baseball, we'll do a special edition of the Midday Midway next on The Score.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
The Midday Midway is brought to you by Amco Transmissions and Total Car Care. At 8 p.m., Chicagoans come out to salute essential workers during their shift change. At 8 a.m., Amco Transmissions and Total Car Care opens to keep Chicagoans' transmissions shifting right. Call 1-800-GO-AMCO or search AAMCO for a location near you. I would say that this would be a situation where we would need to convene the fart police and deputize all that we need to determine what happened. whether or not we're dealing with the primary doctrine of he who smelt it, dealt it, or the alternative doctrine of he who denied it, supplied it. Obviously, that would be the lawyer team. But I have some sad news. The movement to defund the fart police has actually worked. They've been defunded. There's been an investigation. Fart police also racist in some of their practices, over-militarized, and they've been defunded. And now we're going to be reimagining them. We're going to have special social workers that are going to be involved and de-escalation practices because we have done a full internal audit of our operations at the Fart Police, and we need to have a better understanding of our history and why we do what we do. Thankfully, as we go through this reimagination and a rebuilding of our forces to actually protect rather than terrorize, that the forces were not needed at the Travelers in the first round. On the actual first tee for the fourth round, teeing off is Aussie Greg Chalmers, and he's going to hit, and then you're going to hear something on a hot microphone.
You get that? Stay over there. That's supposed to be more silent than that.
Did you get that? That was his playing partner, Ian Poulter.
Did you get that?
As you get that, he immediately took credit for it. And I will, that is pretty spectacular. And it is even parenthetically shown in the closed captioning. And then on Twitter, Ian Poulter said, "The best bit, everyone thinks it was you." A crying laughing emoji. Well, Ian Poulter has owned up to it, and good for him, because that's pretty special. And No, it's not supposed to be more silent than that. What's the fun in that? He had something for you, and there it was. Ladies and gentlemen, Ian Poulter. Yes, sir. And then I...
You get that. Stay over there. That's supposed to be more silent than that.
No, it's not, actually. There was nothing supposed to be at all silent about it. And well, look, you got live microphones out there, and just timing it up, too, exactly right after he crushes that drive on the par four first. It sounds like a commentary on it, but it wasn't, because the drive was certainly good enough. Picked up his tee, started walking. Now, my other thought, though, and I had to go check, because I was going to give him a degree of difficulty score on that, because relatively often, Ian Poulter wears white pants. And I know he's not those of us who are, you know, over 50, where it's a little different degree of risk. But when he was not, he was wearing plaid pants. But there are a lot of pictures of him. If you do an image search of Ian Poulter, there are a lot of times where he is out there with white pants on. And I was going to get me that would be just epic to let something to the trust level that would be involved there. Even so, nicely done, Ian Poulter.
They live in a semi-permanent state of flatulence.
Now, you put white pants on the gorillas, then we got a story. And there was an actual golf stuff that mattered, because Dustin Johnson, in winning that tournament, he is starting to walk with the golfing gods. That was his 21st win after he shot the final round 67. And that drive on 18, holy crap. When all he needs is a par, and he hauls off and whacks one into a crevice, he sends that thing 351 yards. I mean, just an absolute missile. He now, with that win, Dustin Johnson has at least one victory in each of the past 13 years. So you think, who else has won in 13 straight years on the tour? How many other golfers had won in 13 consecutive years? Here's the list that he joins. Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Tiger Woods, Billy Casper, and Lee Trevino. So you're starting to have your name among some golfing greats, and it says something to sustain that level of ability over that time. Dustin Johnson getting pretty close to a Hall of Fame resume and being the major winner that he is. And you'll remember that he lost the U.S. Open, missing the 3-foot putt on the 72nd hole that would have forced the playoff with Jordan Spieth. That was at Chambers Bay. And that was the first golfing broadcast that we saw from Fox, if you remember. And you think, okay, well, why does that matter? What's the deal? Well, the other news that we got yesterday is that Fox wanted out of golf coverage, and they're just out. They started to get concerned about the collision between the major, between the U.S. Open and NFL, and where they're going to put it was going to be on FS1. And then the USGA is like, no, 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 we're not doing that. And then the discussions got bigger and bigger. And Fox is like, you know what? We kind of don't want to have the U.S. Open anymore. So here comes NBC. NBC's going to pick it up again at like half the cost. And everything is going to be right in our world with the U.S. Open back on NBC. The question is Johnny Miller subsequently going to come out of retirement? Because we've gone through this whole thing ever. He and Dan Hicks had the equivalent of like an on-air funeral for the Johnny Miller broadcasting career. I think he's 71 or 72 years old, but I would certainly love to have him continuing to work the U.S. Open and put the band back together. Why not? I just think it would be, first, the fact that they're back in the business, the fact that Fox is out of the golf business is fine. It got better when they got rid of Greg Norman and they figured out, you know, where to put the cameras and how to show you things. And Chambers Bay was not the easiest setup for their first foray into it. But I think this is all good news for those of us who enjoy watching golf. I think it's great. And also, I need to mention this. On the list of great athletes who are spectacularly, thunderously uninteresting, Dustin Johnson has got to be on whatever Mount Rushmore you can put together of people who are great at what they do, who just are, he's so boring, and he doesn't even try to be. It's not like Bill Belichick or Nick Saban or some of these guys that do it like it's kind of a shtick. Like, he is legitimately, actually boring. I don't remember him saying anything. Like, I don't know what's going on there. Probably not much anything. Maybe it's why he can sort of be in that zone out there on the course, but that is one of the single most uninteresting great athletes that I can remember. 13 years ago today, I want you to hear this. I want you to think about this while we talk about the last 13 years for Dustin Johnson. 13 years ago today, I was sitting with Terry. We were doing the show, and we were somewhere off of, I think, like 191st Street, somewhere down in Mokina, Orland, that area. And this was on TV. And we were watching it, and we thought, oh, my God, wow, what a dramatic moment. As you see, the camera was shaking. Cubs were down 5-4, two outs, bottom of the ninth, runner on first, and Aramis Ramirez came to the plate.
So now a one-run ball game. Last chance here, it's Ramirez. Fontenot still at first. The pitch to Aramis. There's a drive. Deep left center. Cubs win. And the Cubs beat the Brewers 6-5. That's seven in a row.
Now, that was memorable. But do you remember what happened in the immediate aftermath? Do you remember what happened? Because something went down. Something happened after that home run.
Was that the Cesar Asturias colonoscopy?
Yes, indeed it was. That was Dr. Asturias and the hot fist injection. That was the Cesar Asturias treatment captured on camera, and it made it onto Twitter, I believe, and slowed down for everyone to see. And I don't know if that's still available somewhere, but It was, he was greeted by his teammates. It was a raucous celebration in the dugout. And as he is being slapped and punched and hugged and kissed, Cesar Asturias came in from out of nowhere and delivered a lower gastrointestinal examination.
Holy heck!
The likes of which had never been seen, and it created. We talked about it on the air, like, what the hell's going on there? And people are calling it, like, yeah, you ever heard of a goose? Like, that's a goose.
That's a goose. That's a whole arm.
That's an assault.
It was elbow deep.
Right, that's, I mean, like, all the way, like, and like cranking it around and just like, rah, rah, rah. I mean, I understand a little bit of giving him the business or a cup check or a tap, but that was, oh my God, what is happening to that poor man? And I don't know if it was just some sort of island tradition we didn't know about, but I'll never forget it. And we were sitting in the bar, and Terry and I looked at each other like, did you see that? And Terry's like, yeah, he's giving him like, hey, buddy. And it will never be forgotten. But that's one of Len's iconic home run calls there. And that was 13 years ago today. And that is a sportsy edition of the Midday Midway. Okay, I teased something coming up. Here's what we're going to do. There has been a movement of late, and there's sort of two levels to this. There have been groups that are trying to cancel the national anthem. And on one level, there is a group that actually wants to do away with the particular song with a Star-Spangled Banner as the U.S. national anthem. And they're talking about the fact that it was written by a slave owner, in large part about slavery, and slaves are mentioned in one of the other verses. But we don't necessarily have to go there with it, because there's a different level that I think merits some attention. And there is a minor league pro soccer team in Tulsa that unilaterally decided that they weren't going to play the Star-Spangled Banner before their games anymore, because they didn't think it fit with their worldview. Okay, that's fine. They decided instead that they, before their games, are going to play Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. Woody Guthrie's an Oklahoma native. And they decided that that song was kinder, gentler, more inclusive, and more essentially currently American. So I thought, if we wanted to do that, if we wanted to actually decide to play a different song of some kind before sporting events, what should we do? Is there a definitive right answer to this? And the texter says it should be canceled because it's racist. It should be canceled because the song sucks. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. But yeah, because O Canada is way better. Maybe we should just sing O Canada because it's just a better song. But if we wanted to, before sporting events, try to tamp down and cancel out some of the politicization of it. And you're standing for America, the flag. And just not make it about that. Just remove that piece. You want to play a song? You want to bring everybody together? You want to have a quiet moment? How do we do it? And then I thought, okay, well, we're dealing with you, the score listener, and you, the Bernstein listener. So there's no way you're going to be able to be serious about this, which is fine. So to start, let's agree to do this. Let's start by trying to figure out what actually would be a good song to do. And then if you're good, in the next segment, we'll get really stupid with it and then really have fun with it, because I've got ideas there too. But I thought this would be a time, as this discussion is beginning now on some levels. We do have a sports team that's going to play This Land Is Your Land. Is that a good one? Another group says do away with Star Spangled Banner and replace it with Imagine by John Lennon. I think that's a little controversial too, because that's, you know, actively a religious, and he's from England, and this country was founded on breaking away from England in the first place. So I don't know why they want to have some guy from England writing a song for this country. So if we're good, if we do this okay, then we're going to earn ourselves a really stupid segment trying to figure out how to have the most possible fun with this. But let's crowdsource it. 312-644-6767. What is the right song to play before our sporting events? That's coming up next on The Score.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!